a fourth of 1% maybe of the people there. There were tens and 20 and 30,000 people, well-organized, disciplined, nonviolent, in a very meaningful way. The interesting thing is about it, if you'd ask most people on the street what the WTO was before Seattle, not very many would even know what you were talking about. Right now, most Americans know what you're talking about. And so, I think it was a very effective demonstration, even though part of it wasn't all it should have been.
Jerry, there was a hand up over there.
I didn't see it.
Oh, actually, it was before this. Okay. And I was just going to comment that last night, and you said it again, there seems to be a distinction between human and non-human. Violence against the environment, you said, is lesser, and I'm not sure I'm comfortable with that. And I think one of the things last night was violence is defined as, and it was something against humans, as opposed to violence against our government, against systems, or violence against property, or violence against nature. I still think those are violent acts.
So you're against the billboard itself. It shouldn't be there.
I think as much as the billboard can be violent because of message, defacing the billboard is violence also.
The billboard being on roof is violent act. If you're saying against nature, it shouldn't be there either. It's not natural.
Well, I tell you what.
That's a whole nother session, probably, but I think it needs to be addressed a little bit briefly. You can get into a real polarizing debate for this and against that. But I think what our world needs now is to learn how to look at things in relation with one another. Human beings have to learn how to live with other kind. That's a term that Larry Rasmussen has coined. Those people other than ourselves and those things other than ourselves, including nature, and that we are an integral part of God's creation together with all of nature. So the billboard isn't wrong. It's not wrong to put up a billboard, but if that billboard is put up in accordance with how it affects all kind, people and nature, then it is harmoniously placed. And violence against all, meaning people and other kind, is an idea of relationship rather than banging our heads against one another and not doing anybody any good.
I'm ready to step down and turn the floor over too. Wow, beautiful, beautiful, great. Well, there are a lot of sessions coming up. One of the things that we're trying to, what this text tries to do and what we're trying to do at LPF is to not get people polarized at the beginning. Because the minute you say capital punishment, almost everybody has a view already. And now the discussion becomes a confrontation that where people have set opinions and they become defensive. So, or militarism, or Kosovo, or Iraq, or abortion. And those things need to be addressed. But the spirituality and practice of nonviolence has to start with understanding a way of life, and later on you start reflecting on those and the specifics, and hopefully people will have a better open mind and come at it not informed by the culture that they've been grown up in, but rather by, well, in our Christian case, what are the scriptural teachings? What is the way of Jesus, and so on. So that's one of the latter parts of this text get into much more structural violence and many issues that the people start almost becoming more defensive about positions at that point. But there's a process to that.
And just to kind of set some of this stuff at ease for now, but one of the definitions from last night, as a matter of fact, from the defining violence, and to get us to that point where we're talking about not wanting to separate, is that violence is anything that separates us from ourselves, from others, or from the earth. And so, and so tonight, again, we'll be talking about those kinds of separations of gender and ecological movements and that. So that is a part of this program, is recognizing the reverence.
Could we have this quick opening meditation? Henry Nguyen writes, how can we live in the midst of a world marked by fear, hatred, violence, and not be destroyed by it? To live in the world without belonging to the world summarizes the essence of the spiritual life. To live in the world without belonging to the world summarizes the essence of the spiritual life. The spiritual life keeps us aware that our true house is not the house of fear, in which the powers of hatred and violence rule, but the house of love, where God resides. Dark powers have pervaded every part of our world to such a degree that we can never fully escape them. Still, it is possible not to belong to these powers, not to build our dwelling place among them, but to choose the house of love as our home. And we're talking here about how do we choose an alternative way of life other than the way of violence which is surrounds us. In this morning's Bible study, it was written here just a minute ago, it's been erased, but she talked about Pax Romana and then Pax Americana. In the biblical time, there was the peace of Rome, and it was the world into which Jesus lived his life, and it was an orderly world, and things were held together, and from the standpoint of the empire, it was a peaceful world. From the standpoint of the underlings in society, those that were the slaves or the people that had lost their land rights or the, you know, and this was a vast majority of people. The Pax Romana was a dominating system that tended to denigrate them as people. And then she had the nerve in the Bible study to suggest that Pax Americana might be just about the same thing.
Well, I was quoting somebody else.
Well, you know, from the empire's point of view, we support peace around the world and the order of an orderly world. But from the masses of people below, they may not see it that way. And there's a lot of indication that there's increasingly disparity between rich and poor and those of power and those without power in our own society. I want to look just briefly at what was that world that Jesus talked about when he talked and when he acted. What was the environment in which he did that? And one way of looking at it, what was the relationship of people of faith at that time to the world or to the ordered society around them, or you could say to violence. And there were John Howard Yoder, as quoted by Schramm in this supplement, Lutheran supplement, lists these different groups. By the way, we talked with the bookstore, and the manual is $15, not $19. If you paid $19, you should go get a refund. But we really are encouraging you to pick these up and to use them not just here, but hopefully, you know, it's our hope that there will be some spin-offs from this back in communities or congregations when you go back
home. Can I just say, we really hope a lot of people will buy it. So I'm going to talk to her and run a tab there. If somebody wants one but can't afford it, I'm happy to buy you one. We just want to get the manuals used and stuff. So that's a textbook for this retreat. We hope everybody will have one. We think it's really good. So feel free to just charge it to me. The important thing is to get you to see it.
Hey, we can't top that offer. Great. Yeah, it is. It's a good one. Would you would you write these down? The religious groupings, first of all, were the Pharisees. And they had an outlook on the world around them. And to simplify their view, it was, you know, the world out there is not very good. In fact, it's pretty corrupt. But if we can just worship and we can maintain our purity of life and keep the laws to achieve that purity, you know, we'll coexist with the world around us. The Pharisees. What were some of the other groups? By the way, I have a hearing problem, so I really have to listen. I didn't hear what you said.
Sadducees.
Okay. You can put those in number two, that's okay.
Okay.
Sadducees or the Herodians, they went together pretty much. They were the group pretty much in power. They cooperated with Rome. They saw Pax Romana as their, you know, as an orderly thing. And incidentally, they made out pretty well in the process. Another group.
Lepers and outcasts.
Mm-hmm. Lepers and outcasts, okay. They weren't a religious grouping as much. And probably the groups that we're naming here, most of them probably didn't belong to any of those groups, or did they?
No, these were elites. All of them are elites. Yeah.
They were cast outside of the system, and Jesus was talking often to they and others that were associated with them. What were some of the other religious groupings?
Essenes.
Okay. And who were the Essenes? What was their outlook on the world? Corrupt as it was, evil as it was.
They were busy writing the Dead Sea Scrolls so we could have something to check.
Basically, withdraw from it, out to seek their own, you know, let the world go to hell. It's bad. We'll try to live, and we'll prepare for the Messiah who might be coming or whatever it is. But withdrawal from the evil world that's around them. And then, is there any other?
Zealots.
Zealots, okay. And the zealots were what?
They were very zealous.
They were those who saw the corruption and the evil, and they were going to set it right, weren't they, by violent action. And basically, these are the four groups, or probably others, the last two represent the typical responses to violence or conflict. That is, fight or flight. Those are sort of instinctual responses that most of us have experienced those responses, haven't we? I mean, I've seen conflict, you know. There's a guy beating his wife and you don't want to have any part of it. You stay away from it. You try to escape it. The Essenes, we're doing that. The Zealots, we're saying, wait a minute, here's an evil thing. We're going to use violence, but it's a justifiable. It's okay to set right an evil deed, even if you have to use an evil deed to do it. And this is a very, very common response. The Pharisees and Sadducees. They weren't escaping in the same way the Essenes were. They weren't. They weren't fighting. The Pharisees were more or less sort of standing aside from the process, saying that spiritual matters really have to be separated from secular affairs, and you try to seek out, you know, the religious life, life of purity and goodness and righteousness, and society, you know, you just have to accept it. It's its own thing. And the Sadducees, of course, we're saying, hey, let's be realistic. There's evil in the world. There's power groups. We'll accommodate ourselves to them, and then we'll try to be as responsible as we can in that situation. Herodians undoubtedly had their sincerity, but totally cooperating and benefiting from the status quo. By the way, the Lutheran Church,
oh dear.
Where would it be in terms of religious identity, and using these terms?
Sadducees.
Which?
The second one, the Sadducees.
Sadducees.
I think so, just with the limiting of the temple worship requirement.
I can't hear you.
I say the Sadducees had the requirement of worship in the temple, though, right? That was the only place that you could worship, but the Pharisees were a little more Lutheran on that.
We sure aren't zealots, are we?
No.
We're sure not Essenes. I don't know. I don't know if we're Pharisees or zealots or Sadducees, but we're probably pretty much there. Being a clergyman, I think sometimes clergy are really hooked into these phases as well. And I think the churches really have difficult. Well, anyway, this was the world in which Jesus really addressed his words and his actions. And Yoder says there's a fifth alternative. And I want to just briefly read from this supplement what he says. He says it was the original revolution. Jesus created a distinct community with its own deviant set of values and its coherent way of incarnating them. He gave a new way of life to live, gave a new way to deal with offenders by forgiving them. He gave a new way to deal with violence by suffering. He gave them a new way to deal with money by sharing it. He gave them a new way to deal with problems of leadership by drawing upon the gift of everyone, even the most humble. He gave them a new way to deal with a corrupt society by building a new order, not smashing the old one. He gave them a new pattern of relationships between man and woman, between parent and child, between master and slave, in which was made concrete a radical new vision of what it means to be a human person. Now, I when I read that, my first reaction was, yeah, there is a fifth alternative to all this. It is what Jesus is all about. Then I felt a little uncomfortable because this seemed to me to be ignoring how power works in society. It seemed to be kind of individualistic, and it seemed to support a wrong understanding of nonviolence that I grew up with. I'm not sure how you might react to this. I want to turn to now briefly, and after a few more comments that I'm going to make here, we're going to turn to Jay's going to be talking about loving our enemies, the way of Jesus, but as Martin Luther King saw it, and then we're going to have a situation of a method or way to deal with conflicting situations nonviolently. But what I grew up with, and I still deal with this, was from Matthew 5, the words of Jesus. And I'm reading it from the King James Version because that's the one I grew up with. It said, "You've heard that has been said of old, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you that ye resist not evil." And so, by golly, if there's a, you got your son, and some of the bullies at school are picking on him, you teach him to just evade it, to escape. But what you don't do is to resist it. And if you're a woman and you're battered in your relationship with your mate, your obligation is to put up with it and try to pray for him and see if you can redeem him. But obviously, that's the relationship you got into, and you're not to resist it. And that was my picture of at least what Jesus was saying. And he went on to say, I say unto you, resist not evil. If whoever shall smite thee on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If any man will sue thee at the law, take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him too. And that was my understanding of nonviolence, pretty much came from this. And I've come to feel and understand this is not the picture of nonviolence as I have it today, at least. Walter Wink is given a great analysis of this writing in his book, Engaging the Powers. And if you don't read anything else he reads, read chapter 9, Jesus' Third Way, Nonviolent Engagement. I'm going to suggest that we just do a little bit of a role play here. How about, you look like a good candidate, come on. I want, Jesus says, if somebody, you know, knife for knife, I say to you, if somebody smites you in the right cheek, turn the other one also. So, go ahead and hit me in the right cheek, will you? Oh, wait a minute. First, what would you tell me your name? Marianne. You know, just you don't have to go through it. Go ahead, hit me in the right cheek.
So I'm supposed to swing?
Yeah.
I really don't want to.
Yeah, well, go through it. You don't have to actually hit me.
Yeah, okay, but I'm supposed to...
Oh, well, wait a minute. What'd you do?
Left cheek.
Do it again.
Left cheek.
Go ahead, hit me. Go ahead, hit me in the right cheek. Oh, wait a minute, yeah. Her, you know, she hit me in the right cheek, but she hit me in the, what's this cheek? No, this cheek. She hit me on the left cheek, didn't she? Why did Jesus say the right cheek? You're going to hit me in the right cheek, you're going to have to use your left hand. And so that's what you did, right? But when you shook hands with me, did you shake left-handed? Did you shake left handed? We shake hands right handed, don't we? Why? Why didn't we shake left handed? Well, it's custom and all. But in our society, but even in primitive societies, even more, the right hand is used, the left hand is used for unclean tasks. And Wink does a pretty thorough analysis of it. In the law, there were penalties for engaging in personal relationships. Exchanging left hand, using left hand. Things done with the right hand. So, hit me, go on, hit me on the right cheek.
On the right.
And that's what Jesus, somebody hits you in the right cheek, turn
it to your left.
Well, you can't use that hand though, because that hand's not, it's not etiquette, it's not proper. It's even against Jewish law, but surely against custom. Well, would that hit me on the right cheek?
Yes, that would.
But how did she do it?
Back of the hand.
When you hit somebody with the back of your hand, are you in mortal combat?
No.
If you're gonna, you know, if it's two people going at it, you're hitting. You're gonna hit with a fist, aren't you? Why do you hit somebody with the back of your hand? Is that an assault against an opponent, or is that the way to humiliate a person? If a man is going to discipline his child, he's not going to bang him, but you slap him on the face. slap on the right hand, you're going to use the back of your hand. And this is an act of a superior to an inferior. It's the act of one who's trying to put down another, humiliating them, disciplining them, and so Jesus, it's in this situation, the situation of a master to a slave, or a husband to a wife, or a man to a woman, or what? One authority figure to a lesser inferior. That's so in that situation, Jesus is saying, you better not fight back. What if a slave starts fighting back with his master? Well, he's in trouble. That's not going to be allowed. But Jesus is saying, okay, you can hit me on the, hit my other cheek, but I refuse to be humiliated. I will not be intimidated. I'm a human being, and I'm not going to be cowardly to you. Go ahead. And you're taking the offensive in this relationship, saying, I will not accept this inferior position that you've placed me in, and what you've tried to dehumanize me, but I'm going to take the upper hand. Now, go ahead. If he reacts to this, he's in trouble. If he says, hey, guards, come in and start flogging this guy, he's recognized me as a person with some strength and with some power. I've opposed him. He can't permit that. Walter Wink says, this example has to be understood in its context, the context of a person superior to inferior in society. It's not the example that we tend to use in our, America should turn the other cheek. Wait a minute, we're not a humble nation, or as an individual, this is not for the strong, this advice. This is advice for a creative response by a person who, in that relationship, is seen as the inferior one. Now, he says the same thing about the other two, and we may talk about those other two in just a minute. But, great job. I did that once as a kid. He actually hit me. It worked. I mean, it really made the point. I've tried to interpret Wink's comments on this. I think they're profound, and it has a lot of other implications. Maybe some of you would like to add some insights.
Along the same lines, now I have heard that also that the Romans wore a glove, that hitting this way was okay, but the back was against the rules. And it was the same line, they were now in trouble for hitting you. And again, it's a challenge. All right, now do it the other way and you have the problem.
It's interesting. Yeah. I haven't heard it, but
I think, and that really brings up, I think the core of what Wink is talking about is that in a domination system, in a domination-based society, there are all manner of different rules and structures. It's this Pax Romana, this kind of relegated system where there are things which you can and can't do. And what Jesus is advocating is that we break the rules. I mean, Jesus was a rule breaker, or else they wouldn't have put him to death. Jesus advocates breaking rules. And one of those rules is that you don't force others to break the rules either. And what he does is he uses all manner of different kind of cryptic advice. One, this turn the other cheek business, and the let them sue you for your undergarment, and let them sue you, or go with them the second mile. To kind of place authorities in the uncomfortable position of having to recognize you as a human who has power, who has their own inherent dignity, and who has the ability to place you in an uncomfortable situation. And that's what I'm going to talk about in a few minutes when we get to Martin Luther King, too, is that that's what the love of enemies is all about, is that when you love your enemies, it breaks rules, and it forces them to recognize something that they
Wink says, why then does Jesus counsel these already humiliated people to turn the other cheek? Because the action robs the oppressor of the power to humiliate. The person who turns the other cheek is saying, in effect, hey, try again, buddy. Your first blow failed to achieve its intended effect. I deny you the power to humiliate me. I deny you that power. I'm a human being just like you. Your status does not alter that fact. You cannot demean me. And he has a lot of other things to say. But it's his... Now, unfortunately, we are good Pharisees, and we have said, we have a rule here. If somebody strikes you, turn the other cheek. We have a new law. And Jesus wasn't giving you laws. Jesus was saying to a particular situation, here is one example of a creative response. Now, the truth is, you're going to have to keep coming up anew in creative responses because situations are going to change. But we applied it as a rule. You know, you meet a situation of conflict like that, violence, you turn the other cheek. It wasn't being submissive at all. It was saying, in that situation, be the most assertive you can possibly be to be who you are, a human being with pride, with, there are limits. You can't challenge the total system. He says, break the law, but break the rule. But, the thing is going to exist out there. But within it, find the most creative response you can possibly come up to. We'll make some more comments about this. Let's turn to the next section, loving your enemies.
Okay. Again, the two most common responses, especially still today, to violent conflict are... this Essenes and the Zealots, or the flight being withdrawing from society, withdrawing from conflict, or the Zealots that is attempting to overtake it. Jesus was born into a society in which these were the two main modes of engaging in conflict, other than this one, which is kind of complacency or complicence. And so what Jesus says is he realizes that the Jewish people have no hope of overthrowing the Roman Empire. And the Jewish people will obviously realize that about 30, 40 years after his death when Jerusalem is completely destroyed. But the Jewish people honestly do not have hope of overcoming the Roman Empire through violent means. It's not going to work. And I think he realizes that in all manner of ways, using violence to overcome violence doesn't work. Again, one of the comments that continually comes up is that it may sometimes affect a change of rulers, but it will never affect a change of rules. But in this particular situation, the most important thing to realize is that the Jewish people had no hope of overcoming the Roman people. They were a very strong and resistant people. They had survived all manner of adversity, but the Roman Empire was just too great. To try and overcome it by violent opposition just wasn't going to work. And so instead of them withdrawing from society, and there are some guesses as to where Jesus might have gone in that time that we don't know about Jesus, from about 12 to 30 or so. And some people actually have talked about the possibility of him going and dwelling with the Essenes. But I think what Jesus finally comes to realize is that we are not going to overcome the Roman Empire by fighting back, but we're certainly not going to overcome the Roman Empire by just sitting around by ourselves and withdrawing from society. But instead, we engage in that society, and that's what Wink talks about when he titles his book Engaging the Powers. And the way in which we do that, and the way that then Martin Luther King makes very clear, which we'll talk about tomorrow morning especially, what Martin Luther King makes very clear in our own society and what Jesus started, and of course Jesus wasn't the founder of this idea, but what Jesus really grabbed onto was that the way to engage the powers is not through fighting them and it's not through flying away from them, but actually by loving them. And what this does is, at first kind of glimpse, this seems to be ridiculous. It seems ridiculous, especially to a people who, from their entire history is, except for a brief time, the time of the kingdoms, is a history of oppression. I mean, they have been oppressed throughout history. And to talk about them turning around and loving the Romans is probably one of the most ridiculous things any of them would have ever heard. And to talk to African American people in our own society, or women, or gays and lesbians, or anyone who is an oppressed person in our own society, the poor, anyone, to talk about then turning around and loving the heterosexual, loving the men, loving the white Americans, is seemingly ridiculous. And yet, what this really does, as we'll see, is it forces a change, because love is, whether we want it to or not, love can be, it doesn't have to be, but it can be coercive, and it can change structures, and it can change situations. Love is the great transformer. Martin Luther King, one of the quotes of Martin Luther King is that we kill our enemies not by killing them, but by making them our friends. That we overcome our enemies, we destroy them by making them our friends. This also comes from the Great Sermon on the Mount, that you have heard that it is said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your heavenly parent. That's Matthew 5, 43 and 4, through 45. Jesus calls us to love our enemies. And the question that Martin Luther King poses is, how do we do that? And he talks about how we must develop and maintain the capacity to forgive. If we cannot forgive, we can't love. Now, obviously, and Jewish people still are today trying to understand what that means, and of course we're trying to understand that in his time period as well. What is the limit of forgiveness? What does forgiveness truly mean? Does it mean that we forget? Does it mean that we excuse? What is forgiveness? But what King talks about is that if we can't forgive, we can't truly love. The evil deed, while not condoned, is not a barrier to restoring a relationship. That is, no evil deed can possibly separate us enough that a relationship cannot be reestablished. And that's something that has to be taken as a given in order for this radical love to really transform a situation. The evil deed never quite expresses all that the other is. Love strives to see the totality of the other person the way that God sees the person. What Jesus does is he attempts to see both the system and the people, and that there are human beings trapped within a system, and that the Romans are a part of that system, and they may have created that system, or at least perpetuated the system, but held within that system, even all the way up to the empire, to the emperor, are human beings. And unless we can understand that they are truly human and recognize part of them in ourselves and part of us in them as that kind of inherent human dignity and inherent dignity that is in the earth as well, that until we can recognize the dignity of life, we can't truly use this kind of radical love to transform that situation. We must act not to defeat the enemy, but to win her or his friendship and understanding. Again, we don't destroy our enemies by killing them, we destroy them by making them our friends. What is the meaning of love in this particular context? Love is not the Greek understanding of eros or philia, that is romantic or aesthetic love, or the kind of reciprocal brotherly or sisterly love or friendship, but it is agape. And agape is that radical kind of love which is extended to the other in such a way that it overcomes the barriers between them. So it's not a love which already exists inside of a relationship, be it erotic or eros love, or love which is the kind of intimate friendship or brotherly or sisterly type of love. It is love which breaks across boundaries and breaks across systems and breaks across the separations that already exist. Agape is a creative and redemptive goodwill and understanding toward all. An overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. Agape is the love of God operating in the human heart. God acts through the world, in the world, through us, extending that kind of radical love to others. Why should we love our enemies? Returning hate for hate multiplies hate. I think that is seemingly obvious, that if you ever attempt to overcome hate by hating, you've simply created twice as much hate. The chain of violence must be broken. Hate scars the soul and destroys the personality, both of the hatred and both of the hated and the hater. Love connects people because it is the way in which we are called to live through this amazing radical love of agape, whereas hate seeks to separate people and it diminishes and destroys our own personhood. Hate deforms, whereas love transforms. Love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. And to be children of God means to actualize our unique relationship with God. And this means acting lovingly toward all. Now, the most pressing question for a lot of people, especially at the brink of any social movement for nonviolent change or for change in general, a question that was certainly asked, something that I've been doing a lot of reading and studying on lately, is the Stonewall Rebellion, the gay and lesbian movement, is that we have been subject to this kind of oppression for so long. Is it practical to even talk to these, to people who are subjects of oppression? Is it practical to talk about love? Is it even meaningful to talk about that anymore? Is it meaningful to talk to a woman who has been raped or a woman who is battered to talk about loving the enemy? Real life is hitting back and getting even. That's what we've come to understand as the way to react to oppression, the way to act to a violent situation. And we have seen throughout history that that just doesn't work. There are times when it has been momentarily effective, perhaps in achieving some kind of military strategic goals, but it doesn't ever stop the cycle of violence. This so-called practical way of hitting back has failed us. King says that finally it is now time to love. Now, again, as I said in the beginning, that though it doesn't have to be and though it doesn't necessarily seek to be, love can be coercive. And the reason is, and this is kind of a key, I think, to what Wink was talking about in that turning the other cheek stuff, that coercion isn't necessarily violent if it seeks love of other and demanding the same in return. What love does is, you see, the structure, the rule is that when someone hits you, you hit back. And of course, if they hit back, then there's more justification to continue to oppress them and continue to crush them. If there were, I mean, and it's obvious in looking at the Stonewall Rebellion that I've been studying recently, that when there was an uprising, it really kicked off a gay and lesbian movement, but at the same time, the immediate response was even more violence and oppression, and even more systemic violence and the, you know, the police getting involved and so forth than ever was before. Hitting back gives justification to continuing that oppression. And what it does is it doesn't break any of the rules. It doesn't change the situation. It's exactly what the oppressor wants. The oppressor wants for the oppressed to hit back because that's what they expect, and it gives them more justification to continue the oppression. What radical agape love does is it transforms that situation and catches them off guard. It creates this dissonance. You see, there's an expectation of a returned hatred, of a returned violence. And if that expectation is broken, it completely catches the oppressor off guard. If the oppressor is wishing, is recognizing that the only legitimate response is that they will either run away or hit back, and yet the response that they get is this kind of radical, all-embracing, humanizing love, it creates a dissonance. It creates a lot of confusion. It creates surprise. And we don't like that. We don't like to be surprised. We don't like to experience dissonance. We don't like when what our expectations are subverted. We don't like it when we have that kind of dissonance in our lives. And the human need, then, is to seek to dissolve that or resolve that dissonance. And if the oppressed continue to love, if they don't break that down, and this is another thing that we'll talk about tomorrow with Gandhi, that if the continued response is love, regardless of the continuing oppression, you see, they'll seek to resolve that dissonance by forcing, at first, perhaps, by forcing even more oppression or more violence onto that. But if the continued response is an all-embracing, humanizing love, and that doesn't bend, then the oppressor will be forced eventually to recognize that as the new rule. And what's done is, what's happened then is that love has transformed the situation rather than conform to the original rule. And it's established a new order, a new peace, which is this relationship that is broken across those borders. And that's the kind of radical love then that we see with Gandhi and with King, talking about how we refuse not only that nonviolence for King meant that we not only refuse to kill our enemies, but we also refuse to hate them, because that hate will never overcome that dissonance, that distance between them. And so a quote from Martin Luther King Jr.'s Loving Your Enemies. To our most bitter opponents, we say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We shall meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we shall continue to love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. Throw us in jail, and we shall still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and we shall still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our community at the midnight hour, and beat us and leave us half dead, and we shall still love you. But be ye assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer. One day we shall win freedom, but not only for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. And I think that there's an obvious connection that I'm sure many of us already make with that, that wearing the oppressor down with the capacity to suffer is exactly what Jesus does with his entire life and with his death. That his death is the radical fulfillment of that agape love. That so much is his capacity to suffer, that event, the cross, transforms that situation and shows to us the example of extending that capacity to suffer to the point to which it achieves a double victory, that is victory in what we wish to accomplish, but also the victory in transforming the opponent. So the point is not to overcome the opponent, because that's another system of domination. It is instead to transform the opponent and to not have that dissonance between them in the first place. Are there questions or comments on that?
Yeah, in our society, I think especially women have been trained to suffer, and that we automatically now, because of our history with the last couple generations of women in particular being trained to suffer in relationships and in the world, have a skewed idea of what that means to suffer. And so when I hear it, that's what I hear. Okay, we're just going to sit there and take it and take it and take it. And seeing my mother's generation slide into depression and suicide and non-living, that's what we need to, I think we need to talk about how your idea is different from that. Because I see that it is different, but I can't put words to it yet.
Absolutely.
And that Jesus was different than that too.
Yeah. I think one of the things that Wink talks about is that there is room for rage. There is definite room for rage, and it is a motivator. That this kind of capacity to suffer is coupled with a very rageful activity, and that is that love is an intense emotional force, an absolutely intense emotional force that has the power to transform situations. Rage is also a very intense emotional force. And if those two can somehow be connected, if the rage that you have against the oppressor, against the situation, can be injected into your capacity to love, it becomes a transformative kind of situation. Whereas if the love is understood simply as this, let it be, and that I'll continue loving you no matter what you do to me, that is true. That is our calling, is to continue loving. But sometimes love isn't just sitting there and taking it. Mm-hmm. A part of love is using that rage to transform a situation, to get the hell out of there, and to love in a safe and a comfortable situation.
Well, that's a whole new idea, and I think, first of all, of how skilled a person must have to be to do that. But I think that's exactly right. I think that's a training or a teaching that needs to... That's good.
And one of the things, tonight we're talking specifically about gender issues and gender violence. And one of the things that we'll talk about is the need for education. In that, if love is the only thing that's taught, a lot of times the problem, one of the critiques of nonviolence, especially from feminist friends of mine in this nonviolence group that I have at my campus, is that the all of the responsibility is on the oppressed, is on the victim. That if the responsibility is to just continue loving, and no matter how brilliant or transformative that love is, and none of the focus is on what is the oppressor hearing, what is that, you know, that one of the examples is that so many times in middle school or high school, sometimes in health class or in other situations, we'll bring the young girls or the young women aside and say, well, now if you're ever touched inappropriately or if this ever happens, this is what you can do, or this is, you know, if this situation ever happens, these are the people that you call. But when do we take the young men aside and say, well, this is the language that you are not to use, this is the situation that you are not to be involved in, these are the things that are just blatantly inappropriate, you know, that when do we teach the oppressor what is acceptable and not? When do we place that responsibility on the person who is not the victim? So, and that's something that we'll definitely talk about tonight. But
just a little addendum on that is that it transfers over to men as well in all our society. If you're nice, you're not angry at, you know, you're not angry, and you do this love and you get stepped on. So it's not just the women. It's
right. But, yeah. Absolutely.
Could I just let me read just something that Wink says to this issue. He says, women beaten by their husbands are told to turn the other cheek and let the man continue to brutalize them, and no reference to Jesus' actual intention. If we enter the freedom Jesus sought to establish, we would rather counsel the battered to seize the initiative, force her husband to recognize her right, expose his behavior publicly, break the vicious cycle of humiliation, guilt, and bruising. The most loving thing a battered wife could do might possibly to have her husband arrested. Gandhi, he quotes, I do believe that where there is a choice between being cowardice and violent, I would advise violence. This is Gandhi saying this. But he says, I do believe that nonviolence is infinitely superior to violence. But we got to go on. We're moving on to one more section, but
can I just say one thing on this? Go ahead.
Yes.
I think the question is really important, Kristen, and I don't know what I think yet, and I really struggle with it because I teach a course on the Bible and pastoral care where we really talk about domestic violence and battering a lot. But one thing that's been very powerful to me is in this decade of nonviolence in the Lutheran Church's leadership on this. The Commission for Women has taken a leadership role. Jean Martinson, who's not with us here, but the idea that somehow teaching nonviolence is profoundly a feminist issue too. I'm working on that myself, but I think I really trust them in taking this lead too. But I think it is a very difficult double bind that women are in. You know, even fairy tales like Beauty and the Beast, this idea that somehow if you stay with a violent guy, you'll be able to turn him into, you know, this precious thing. It's a very dangerous myth that we're in as women. And I think what you're doing in questioning is really, really important. But I'm trusting and going along with this, I guess, because I do see the most sort of feminist department of the church believing in this. So I'm still struggling, but I'm convinced there's something.
Great. We're leaving this right at a real point is going to have to continue on in the following sessions. But we want to do a little, how do, some techniques.
Okay. I was going to say, do we have time for it? Because we could do it tonight, too. What would be better?
Do we have until a quarter of, when is this over with?
For 12.
I believe.
Go to 12.
Is it 11:30 or quarter 12?
It's over when we leave.
Well, I tell you what, you can leave now, or you can leave at a quarter off.
Our worship is at 12.
So we can go until about 10 or 12.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Well, there are several, many techniques for putting active nonviolence into practice, and we're going to explore one. It's a four-step process adapted from Bill Moyer, and it's been suggested that this could be used internationally as well as interpersonally and all levels in between. Bill Moyer is an activist and an author, and he developed this technique when he was working with men who battered women. I think at this point we're going to let our two people who are doing the role play, Barbara and Kent, leave the room for a second to develop their characters a little bit. So Barbara and Kent, you can exit, and we'll just talk a little bit about this four-step process that we'll hopefully see in action. And the first step is centering ourselves, and that's described as finding your true self. So instead of becoming a prisoner to a role that you feel like you should play as a victim or as an oppressor, to find your true self, and maybe another way to describe it would be finding your true self so that you can respond instead of react. And from that place, one would be able to disclose our true self. And I think of this as an I statement. I don't know if we're all familiar with I statements, but finding out what is it that our true self feels. I feel really disappointed right now. I feel really angry right now. And be able to recognize that in yourself enough to verbalize it to our opponent, because then the next step is receiving the truth of the opponent. And this is where me and my opponent are to hear what each other has to say. And it doesn't mean agreeing at this point, but acknowledging each other's truths. And then the fourth step is to make agreements now that we've done these previous three. We're ready for you to, I should set the stage. This is a Holden transportation issue.
Hi, Ken. I'm just coming by to make sure that you're going to let me borrow your car next week. Or I guess it's a week after. I think it was January 10th and 11th. I'm just checking one last time to make sure.
Oh, down at Fields Landing?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Oh,
Yeah, you said it wouldn't be a problem.
You did remind me about, I seem to remember something about that.
Yeah, remember we just talked about it last week. You said it would be fine.
Did I really? No, I don't remember that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was sort of our understanding. Remember?
Well, why do you need the car anyway?
Well, I need to get out of here. I'm feeling trapped at Holden, and I need to go out, and I need to drive around. I have to drive to...
We all feel trapped. I mean, we're all in this place together.
Yeah, but remember, this is why... I mean, I don't want to bring it up again, but I paid part of the insurance, and you agreed that you would let me use your car when I needed
it. You paid the insurance once.
Yeah, well, it was
for
6 months.
You helped me cover a payment.
Yeah, and that was our understanding, is that I would get to borrow your car. I don't get what the problem is.
Yeah, maybe we could talk. Could you do this trip in February or March?
No.
To now?
I need to go these days. I've got people I was going to meet.
Oh, you're going to meet people?
Yeah. I need to drive to see him. You agreed, Kent. I don't get what the problem is here. I'm stuck up here at Holden. I need a car.
You know, the real issue here is that...
Don't you trust my driving? What's the problem?
No, I trust your driving. It's all the, you know, the raisins in between the seats and the rolled up tissue paper all over the place.
What do you mean? I put this stuff in the wastebasket.
But there were still, you know, there were all kinds of little bits, and I sat down and stuff. And
okay, I'll try to be cleaner. I'll get to the boat a little bit earlier, and I'll clean up your car before I come up on the boat next time. If that's the problem, I think it wasn't as messy as you think, but I'll try to clean it up more.
Well, maybe I just have to, I don't know if that's it or if there's something else. Or...
Well, I feel like you're trying to avoid, I don't get what the problem is. It sounds like, it sounds like you don't trust me.
That's probably true. tell you what, let me think about this for a couple of minutes, come back, and we'll have coffee in the Holden coffee store, the Holden Hotel. Mm-hmm.